We were speaking about the Pelagian controversy, and we noticed, one, the outbreak of the controversy, two, we noticed Pelagius in Palestine, and then we noticed the controversy in the West. And under that, we looked at small a, the North African Synod of 416, and then b, the letter of Bishop Innocent. And the African synods had written to the Bishop of Rome saying how terrible this Pelagian heresy was and how widespread in Italy and Sicily, pointing out its errors and asking that the Bishop of Rome should put his authority along with theirs in trying to put a stop to it. Still they have. Never had a day like this. They made all kinds of statements in it of how much it would mean to the church if he would take such a stand and so on, and he was so pleased he wrote back appreciating their recognition of the authority of the Bishop of Rome, and as McCabe says, just practically falling over himself to express his gratitude for such an unusual letter as he had received from them and expressing his concurrence with it. And then we noticed the Augustine's famous sermon in which he said, two synods have acted, and the Apostolic See in Rome has expressed agreement with us. The cause is finished. Would that the error would it quickly be done away with. And of course, that has been quoted all through the centuries as Rome has spoken, the cause is finished. But all your recent Roman Catholic books recognize that that is a misquotation, that that is not what he said at all. Although, as I pointed out to you yesterday, some try to say that what he actually said is just as effective. Actually, of course, it is entirely different. Let's see his famous sermon, and then I glanced forward yesterday at the fact that even as he gave the sermon, a boat was on its way to Italy, from Italy, carrying a message from the new pope, Bishop Zosimus. And in this message, Bishop Zosimus reversed the attitude of Pope Innocent. Now, reversed is a little too strong word. He did not say, we definitely take a stand that Pelagianism is right. But he did say, do not take any stand against Pelagianism. It is, we have to look into the matter. We do not know for sure what stand we should take on it. We must look into the matter. But he did away with the position that Innocent had taken. And he said that everyone in his court, their eyes filled with tears, they thought of such wonderful men as Pelagius and Celestius being so maligned and so criticized. Yes? Zosimus. Zosimus. So there's a small d, the action of Bishop Zosimus. And this letter strongly rebukes the Africans for their opposition to Celestius and Pelagius, strongly rebukes them, says that he must look into the matter further before he can take any stand on it, but gives them a strong recommendation as men to the two leaders of the Pelagian movement. Now, small e, the African Council of 418. Very soon after this message came from Zosimus, they called a council of all of North Africa again. They went into the matter, they repeated in the strongest terms their condemnation of Pelagius and of his view. They expressed it in the strongest terms, so you can see that they were in no sense considered themselves as subject to either the actions or the ideas of the Bishop of Rome. But under Augustine's influence, they were completely hostile to the teaching of Pelagius. Now, there was an appeal made to the emperor that the emperor should take a stand against this heresy. The emperor, perhaps I could say a word at this time about the situation in the empire, though really I won't go into it much here because we will deal with that at the beginning of our next main section. But you remember Theodosius, the great emperor, who had reestablished order in the empire and who had held the Council of Constantinople Theodosius was such a great man, such an able man, such a powerful man, that at his death there was no question but that his sons would succeed him. And this again shows the absurdity of the hereditary system, a system which has brought misery to most nations which have followed it. The fact that a man is able proves nothing about what his sons are going to be. And in the case of Theodosius, he had two rather weak sons, very weak sons, who would never have lasted either one of them more than 2 or 3 years as emperor if it were not for the situation of being so well established by their powerful and able father. But the result was that the kingdom, the empire, was divided now into two parts, which is not a new thing. It had been divided, you remember, by Diocletian, and it had been in two parts and brought together and separate and brought together 2 or 3 times in the previous century. Now it was divided, and never since has it been united. I'm sure no one realizes that Theodosius' death was so important politically in this regard. It was divided between his two sons. I don't think you need to bother about the name of Arcadius, the one who ruled in the east. He lived a number of years and carried on with great pomp and glory in his kingdom, all the recognition for his tremendous position, but he was actually pretty much of a weakling. But in the west, Honorius, H-O-N-O-R-I-U-S, perhaps his name is worth remembering, H-O-N-O-R-I-U-S, who was 11 years old at his father's death, became emperor in the west. And so it was ruled by regents and so on until he became of age, and after that it was whoever was his favorite. But in the imperial court at this time, there were those who felt that Augustine was certainly right in this controversy, and an edict came from Honorius that Pelagianism was wrong, that it should not be propagated in the Roman Empire, that this was something that was contrary to sound doctrine or sound judgment. And these strong edicts came out from the imperial headquarters, which was now at a town called Ravenna in Italy, somewhat north, quite a distance north of Rome. And so these edicts came out, and not long after, we find a very different attitude on the part of the Pope. The Zosimus changed attitude. Now, whether Zosimus changed his attitude because of the arguments advanced from North Africa, or whether he changed it because of the edicts that came from the north of him, from the emperor, or what entered in, we can't tell. Zosimus was only pope about a year and a half or so before his death anyway. But he now took a strong stand against Pelagianism. He declared that Pelagianism was absolutely contrary to sound doctrine, that it had no place in the Catholic Church, that all bishops who held this view should be deprived of their position. And many bishops who had been strongly favoring Pelagius and Celestius previously now decided that they had never really favored Pelagius. And so there were many who declared their adherence to the new view given by the Pope. There were, however, a group of about 20 who gave up their bishopric and who gave up their position, and theoretically, Pelagianism was now completely banned in the Western Church. And actually, it did mean a good many bishops who lost their position, and Pelagius and Celestius no longer had the chance of presenting their doctrines and ideas in the Western Church. They went again to the East, where they were received under the protection of the Bishop of Constantinople, who gave them his support, but who didn't live long after this. So that's a very brief episode. Yes?
Yeah. Yeah, it was in Italy, actually, that the change took place. But Italy is where it had the greatest extension. Italy is where Celestius and Pelagius, Italy and Sicily, where they had presented their ideas most widely, where they had the greatest number of followers. And those who gave up their positions rather than to recant their views were Italian bishops. I suppose some of it was in Spain and France, those countries, but they don't enter much into the account at this point. But in Italy, they said it was the result of the papal action. And my guess is that the imperial court would prefer that ecclesiastical authority should dominate in the church and that they should officially interfere, please. But we wanted to mention number four. Number three was the Western, the controversy in the West. The controversy was not altogether over because Augustine knew there were many people who still held it and kept on writing against it, sending out discussions and so on. But it had no official supporters anymore. But number four is worth giving, as you see, a rather important head, Julian of Eclanum. Julian of capital Eclanum. Here was a bishop, a young bishop, a son of an old friend of Augustine, a man who was highly respected, who not only accepted Pelagian views, but who strongly supported them. And though he lost his position and he went and became a school teacher for the rest of his life, he constantly sent out writings in favor of Pelagianism and attacks on the views of Augustine. And Augustine answered. And right to the time of his death, Augustine was still concerned with answering Julian's argument. But from this time on, Pelagianism was not openly, directly avowed in almost any part of the Christian church, except for the followers of Julian of Eclanum until their death. And Augustine had pretty well killed any willingness of people until comparatively recent years to out openly call themselves Pelagians. But number five, Augustine's doctrine of predestination. Augustine laid such great stress upon the deity, upon the sovereignty of God in salvation, the absolute necessity of the grace of God for salvation at every step of the process, that he also, along with it, laid considerable stress on the idea that God had predestined those to whom he would give his grace from all eternity. And this came to be known as the mark of a thoroughgoing Augustinianism, to hold to an individual election or predestination of the individual to whom the grace of God would be given from all eternity. Now this, they would say, was pure Augustinianism, and most writers on the subject feel that pure Augustinianism almost died with Augustine and came to life again with Calvin. You had a question?
I think you might be lost
a little bit more, but I remember Julian. Who was he? Yes, Julian was a bishop, a son of an old friend of Augustine, a man highly regarded, who continued the controversy for a number of years, even though he was no longer bishop. No, he was in Italy. Eclanum is in Italy. I suppose maybe you don't all know that Eclanum is in Italy, but he was a bishop in Italy, and we're not going, with only 2 years to cover all of church history, to go into details of this phase, the controversy. The power was now all against Pelagianism, but Augustine devoted many hours to writing answering Julian's argument and writing against it. And so I felt it was important to give him a separate number here, even though we don't go into detail much on. Yes? The controversy, he doesn't. In the East, at this time, Pelagius and Celestius were now in Constantinople, under the support of the Bishop of Constantinople.
But in the East, they never got greatly concerned about this, not so much, at least about the doctrinal points involved. The Eastern Church seems to have always been more concerned about the person of Christ, the nature of the relation of the person to the Godhead, and so on, and not so much about matters of soteriology. While in the West, the tendency was to take a firm stand on whatever seemed to be the simple, clear biblical position on the points of the Trinity and of the person of Christ, and not get greatly concerned about trying to explain it, but on these matters of soteriology, there was great argument and discussion in the West. In the East, we noticed the controversy in the East, but it largely was a personal matter there, even though it did get so strong that Jerome's place was burned down during the course of the controversy. But now, number five, Augustine's doctrine of predestination. Consideration of this really belongs in systematic theology rather than here. It does not enter a great deal into the argument at this point, except that Augustine comes out very strongly on it, and his statements had great influence 1,200 years later, 1,100 years later at the time of the Reformation. While at this time, those who simply followed Augustine took all of his views on this, but the bulk of them, even though admitting Pelagius was right, did not follow Augustine's idea of predestination. And now McSorley's history, for instance, speaks of the predestination controversy, which was ended with this view being ruled out as far as the church was concerned, according to McSorley, within a period of a century after Augustine's death. But number six glances forward at a subject we'll look at more in detail later, the Council of Ephesus. The Council of Ephesus, which is 431 A.D. That is after Augustine's death. It is important to mention it here because the Bishop of Constantinople, who protected Pelagius and Celestius, was condemned by the Council of Ephesus on account of his views about the person of Christ. And we'll go into that fully later. We have looked forward briefly to that at an earlier time when we looked at the beginning of the Christological controversy. We'll look at it in detail next semester. So at this point, all that concerns us is that along with the action of the Council of Ephesus condemning wrong views of the person of Christ, there was also a condemnation of Pelagianism. And Pelagianism never had much hold in the Eastern Church because in the East they're not so much interested in this phase of theology as the West was. But it was ruled out, officially at least, in the East and in the West after the Council of Ephesus, the third ecumenical council, which we will look at later in detail. But at this point, most people who can tell you about the great councils of the church may not even realize that this was one of the actions of the Council of Ephesus, because the other actions loom so large in the whole situation. But in the discussion of Pelagianism, it certainly is of importance, and so I mention it here, Council of Ephesus 431. And then we glance forward to number seven, later history of the controversy, semi-Pelagianism. Semi-Pelagianism describes an attitude which went rather far in the direction of Pelagianism and probably represents, to quite an extent, those bishops who bowed to the Bishop of Rome, the orders of the Bishop of Rome, declared Pelagianism wrong and yet went pretty far toward it in their view. But all church historians consider that during the next couple of centuries, there was a fairly strong movement which they speak of as semi-Pelagianism, but which they think of as having come to an end within the next two centuries. And that leads to number eight, which they like to call semi-Augustinianism. Now, semi, we think of as half. So semi-Pelagianism and semi-Augustinianism, if it's halfway between the two, ought to be identical. I think it'd be better if they used the word for third instead of a half. They were perhaps about a third of the way from Pelagianism to Augustinianism, the movement which was defeated, but those who defeated it took the movement which was about halfway between that and Augustinianism. And they denied predestination, and they did not take a strong stand on the grace of God that Augustine took. But Pelagianism as a term was utterly anathema from this time on. And anyone who would declare himself a Pelagian would be considered as outside the pale, and when they would criticize people all through the next 1,000 years or more, if they would declare a man to be a heretic, they were pretty sure to call him a Pelagian along with other names which might be put upon him. But at least Protestants considered that the Western Church from this time on was only semi-Augustinian after the defeat of semi-Pelagianism, and that pure Augustinianism was lost until Luther and Calvin revised it 1,100 years later. Well, now we will look at another very interesting phase of Augustine's life at which we have already, we will gather together some threads that we've already looked at of another important phase of his life. Capital L, Augustine and the Church of Rome. Augustine and the Church of Rome. And under this, we'll say, number one, the immediate effect of Augustine's work on the development of the Roman system. The immediate effect of Augustine's work on the development of the Roman system. And under this, there is small a, is the Donatist controversy. As you know, the great, long-continued effort which Augustine carried out to put an end to the Donatist schism began with his making all kinds of friendly offers to the Donatists to just come and reunite and unite with them and do away with this schism. Augustine declared over and over that he did not want forced fusion, that he wanted persuasion, he wanted intelligent discussion. He wanted them to see the error of their way. He wanted the Donatists to join with the Catholics and have the two bishops serve together, and then whoever survived continued. He did not want them put out of their churches or anything like that. But as the controversy went on, and as there was the persecution by the Circumcellioni and these other wild fanatics who were connected with the Donatists, and as some of them resorted to rather untrue arguments and attitude, Augustine's attitude hardened more and more, until by the end of the Donatist controversy, Augustine was taking the position that it was something which should not be permitted at all, and was even asking for the secular state to help in certain cases in turning over the Donatist churches to the Catholics. And thus, his attitude, in fact, the whole argument of the Donatist controversy, pushed in the direction of one church with closely knit together. And, of course, this was a help toward the development of the Romanist system, as we knew it in the Middle Ages. Now, although we have no evidence that Augustine ever considered the Bishop of Rome as in any way superior to himself, even though he was only bishop of a comparatively small city, and not by no means the leading position in the Church of Athens. Small b, the city of God. The city of God. We've already looked at that great book that Augustine wrote. And we have noticed that as far as the argument is concerned, there is nothing in the book which would support the development of a system throughout the world by in which the Bishop of Rome would have the power which is claimed today. If a bishop of any town in America dies, the Bishop of Rome today in the Roman Catholic Church appoints his successor. People in New York about 25, 30 years ago were very disgusted in the Roman Catholic Church in New York when their Bishop of New York died. And instead of one of his associates in the New York Church being appointed bishop, the Pope appointed a man who was an old friend of his, whom he had known when they were both in school together in Rome, and who had been a member of the Secretariat in Rome for a time, who was now assistant to the Bishop of Boston. And when Spellman came down to New York, there was no one to meet him at the train. And he didn't know how he would get along with these people in New York, none of whom wanted him for bishop at all. But these were the Pope's orders. And Spellman proceeded to take over control in New York, and he was a very able man, and within a few years he had the complete support of the clergy of New York. But it is questionable whether any Roman Catholic layman or clergyman in New York would have voted for him to be Bishop of New York. According to the system as it is at present, the Pope claims the complete authority to regulate the church throughout the world as he chooses. Now, we hear a great deal about the infallibility of the Pope, and that is pretty much of a red herring. Claim of papal infallibility is so hedged about with explanations that actually it doesn't amount to anything much. I think the Pope has made not over 2 infallible statements in the last 70 years, and those have been worded so very carefully and so casually that it's pretty hard to be sure exactly what they mean, either. But everything else the Pope has said, he would say he was not speaking ex cathedra. We hear all this about infallibility, but the really important thing is the authority which the Bishop of Rome claims. He claims an absolute authority over the church. He claims that Christ gives this absolute authority to Peter, and that Peter, when he became Bishop of Rome, according to their theory, some way the authority passed away from the man to the city, which was, according to their theory, the last city he was bishop of, because they think he was bishop of Jerusalem first, and then bishop of Antioch, and then bishop of Rome. But you find no trace of any such idea, whatever, in Augustine's writings, that the bishop of Rome had any power or influence other than what would naturally come to the head of a church in the greatest city of the empire, one of the largest churches, and naturally a man who would be expected to be a man of very considerable wisdom and very considerable personal power. And the strange thing is that so few of the bishops of Rome seem to have been outstanding in any way during the first 4 centuries of the Christian church. But his book, The City of God, the idea of it, did give a tremendous impetus in the Middle Ages to the idea the city of man has disappeared. Paganism's gone. Rome, the great emperor of the world, is no longer the political ruler. But there is a city of God, and there is a bishop in Rome who has a right to have authority over at least the spiritual life of all those who belong to the city of God. And so it was the concept of the book, rather than any of its actual teaching, that contributed to the development of the Roman system. Then, number 2, the ultimate effect of Augustine's work in this regard. The immediate effect was to some extent to give an impetus forward to the development of the hierarchical Roman system and of the idea of one church with a control in the center. But the ultimate effect was felt at the time of the Reformation, when Luther and Calvin and others read Augustine's work and were impressed with his arguments about the grace of God and the relation of the individual to God and so forth. And in the end, it became a great force against this Roman system. And so, as someone has said, Augustine is the great authority of the Protestants and the great authority of the Romans. But each uses different parts of his work, and each uses different parts of his influence. Number 3, Augustine's personal relations with the bishops of Rome. His personal relations with the bishops of Rome. There are 3 points we should notice under this. Small a, the famous sermon. And that we have discussed under the other head, but it deserves notice under this head. The famous sermon. And small b, his reaction to Zosimus' attitude. There's not the slightest evidence that he thought of subordinating his ideas to what Zosimus said, but he
tried to get the African church together to take a strong stand against it. And then small c, other matters. There are a number of the situations that occurred in North Africa during the last few years of Augustine's life, which concern the relations of the Church of North Africa with the Bishop of Rome. But in these, it's not always easy to tell just how much Augustine personally had to do with it. He is such a tremendous influence in North Africa at this time that almost anyone asked his opinion on almost any matter that came up, simply because he was such a great mind and so very influential with his writing that it's pretty hard to think that he was not personally concerned with all of these matters to some extent at least. But there were a number of cases where bishops of Rome in these 20 years tried to interfere in the African church. And the Africans were always very courteous. None, I shouldn't say all, were generally very courteous in their relation to the Bishop of Rome. They were generally very courteous, but they declared that he had no right to interfere in their affairs. And they took an action once or twice to declare that no African ecclesiastic had a right to appeal to any authority outside of North Africa. And of course, the whole idea of the Roman system today is that they, at any part of the world, they have a right to appeal. They are directly under the Bishop of Rome. And in one case, when a representative of the Bishop of Rome tried to interfere in the case of a presbyter in North Africa who had been removed from his position for cause, who had gone to Italy and declared he'd been unjustly treated, and the Bishop of Rome ordered he should be reinstated, and the African stood by his bishops and refused to reinstate him, he quoted from what he said were the canons of the Council of Nicaea, that the Bishop of Rome should have authority over other churches. And the African said, we have great regard for the Council of Nicaea, but we have never seen it. It's not in our copies. And so they sent and they got precise copies of the canons of Nicaea, and there was no such statement in it. And then they found that it was a council held at Sardica, which is not recognized as a national, as a general council by any church, which had passed these. And they wrote a letter to the Bishop of Rome, which McSorley speaks of and says the North African church was disgusted at what it considers the wrong actions of the legates of the Bishop of Rome. And of course, it said it was his representative who they said had improperly represented these things and had done wrong in relationship. So there was a fair amount of attempts to the Bishop of Rome to interfere in the church of North Africa at this time, which were generally answered very courteously but firmly, but occasionally, as in this case, were answered with rather strong language. And there certainly is no evidence that Augustine, who was at least four times as able and four times as intelligent as any bishop of Rome during his time, ever took any attitude of subservience in any way towards the Bishop of Rome. Now this was Augustine's relationship to Rome was L. Let's call M Augustine's other writings. Augustine's other writings. You think what we covered would be enough writings for one man who had nothing to do but write. And certainly enough for a man who was busied in all of the affairs of his bishopric and in many affairs in other parts of North Africa as well. He was a very busy man, and yet the things we've looked at are only a portion of what he wrote. In his latter years, a mercenary army was sent into North Africa by the emperor to try to protect North Africa against the tribes to the south that occasionally broke through the line and attacked, and against invasions from the west. And this army was composed of people who were Arians. You remember that Ulfilas, the great missionary to the Goths, had gone and had reduced the Gothic language to writing, and who had won so many thousands to Christianity of the Goths, that Ulfilas
did not really enter into these controversies or know much about them, but he came from an Aryan group, and he taught the Goths Arianism. And the result was that though in the Roman Empire, among the citizens of the Roman Empire, Arianism was completely dead since 381, the Council of Constantinople. The Gothic soldiers, the Germanic soldiers who came in, were nearly all Arian. And so the group of these soldiers came to Hippo, and there was an Arian bishop with them who entered into argument with Augustine. And so Augustine writes a book on Arianism this time, toward the end of his life. And Augustine wrote many commentaries. Some have considered his great commentaries on the Psalms, which consisted of a long series of sermons, commenting on the whole book of Psalms as among his greatest works. He did not write a complete commentary on the Bible, but he wrote commentaries on many sections of the Bible. And then he did something which very few writers have done. In about 3 years before his death, he wrote a work which he called the Latin word, which translated roughly into English would be retraction. Retractione, the Latin word, from which our English word retraction comes, but it's not a particularly good translation, because it isn't really retraction, it's a survey of his writing and a discussion of it, in order to point out how his thought has developed and where he has changed his mind from something that he may have written in his earlier days. And so you will find a certain amount of retraction in it, where he says, I said this 40 years ago, and I see I was mistaken. There's occasional statements like that, but in general, it is a survey of his writing and a statement of his present attitude toward the matters that he discussed in all these various writings. And it really is amazing just how much Augustine did write. There were hundreds, literally hundreds of books, which are discussed in his retraction, in this survey of it. And of course, it's very nice to have his statement as to what he had written, because in the case of Jerome and some others, there were many books that thought to be written by them, later proven to have been written by Pelagius or some other writer. But in Augustine's case, we have this survey, a valuable instrument for the study of his book. There are two volumes of it discussing his writings and his books. He intended to make a third in which he would go through his letters and discuss his letters, but he never got time to write the third volume. But the writings of Augustine is tremendous what he covers, and when you think how he could do all this along with his practical activity, just an indication, an example of his practical activity, at this time when he was well over 60 years of age, he made a trip west and visited an African town called Caesarea. And there was a retired Donatist bishop who had been put out of the church when the Catholics had won out in the Donatist controversy, and Augustine tried to engage him in discussion and tried to get an opportunity to present to the people the reasonable basis of the actions that had been taken. So much of his thought and time was taken up in dealing with this man. And then he heard that in this town there was an old tradition of the Caterva, as they called it. The Caterva was a faction fight which once a year took place, and it would run through 3 days. And the people of the town would choose up sides, and often members of the same family would be on different sides. But then for these 3 days they would fight, throwing stones at each other and attacking in every way possible, and many people were killed every year in the course of the faction fight. That is an old, old tradition, and the people would not change the old tradition of the town. But Augustine gathered the people together and preached against the Caterva. And after he had preached a while, he was able so to move them that they began to apply. But he kept on preaching, and arguing against it until finally the people, many of them gave way to tears. And in tears of repentance, they declared that they would never do such a thing again. And the old tradition was ended of the Caterva in Caesarea. But you can think of the energy and the time and the effort
concerns in entering into situations like this time after time in his life. And yet he found time and energy to do all of this right. Now, capital M, the last days of Augustine. The last days of Augustine. And under this, number one is the political development. And the political development in the last days of Augustine is a very interesting situation, but not particularly important for us except for the results it led to. And so I'm going to very hastily run through a little of the political situation here that occurred. There was a man in North Africa called Boniface, who had been sent there, Count Boniface, as the governor of North Africa. And Boniface was sent as an envoy to meet with a Germanic tribe in Spain called the Vandals. And there he fell in love with the daughter of the chieftain of the tribe. And he married him, and he brought her back to North Africa with him. I should say a word about these Vandals. Vandal was one of the various Germanic tribes. From this tribe, as from others, there were mercenary soldiers in the Roman army. In fact, the leading general of Honorius was a Vandal, a man named Stilicho. And he defended the empire and held back the attacks of the barbarians for many years, Stilicho did, until finally his enemies worked up a plot which resulted in his being executed. And that greatly weakened the empire when Stilicho was gone, and contributed to the Goths being able to come through Italy and to sack Rome, which, remember, took place in 410. Now, this Vandal tribe had gone from the east clear across Europe into France and then down into Spain, and now they were in Spain. And Boniface had married the daughter of the Vandal chief, and he was the count ruling in North Africa. But Honorius had died, and his young son, 6 months of age, became emperor, which meant that the little child's mother actually ruled, and she became very suspicious of Boniface. And she was suspected on account of his wife being a Vandal, too. And so, different things he had done led her to suspect that he was going to make himself supreme in Africa and break off from the empire, and she sent word to him to come to Italy for consultation, and from what he heard, he was quite sure they would execute him as they had Stilicho before. So he declared his independence, and then he immediately got in touch with the Vandals. He defeated the armies he sent in two great battles, but he knew that the whole power of the empire would be beyond what he could resist. So he got in touch with the Vandals, and he said, come over to Italy, to Africa, and help me, and I will give you half of North Africa if you will help me protect it against the power of the Roman Empire. And so the Vandals decided to leave Spain and come down, and the Spanish people were so glad to get rid of them that they furnished boats to take them across the Mediterranean there to North Africa, and they helped. 40,000 Vandals came down with their families, and the whole group migrated from Italy into North Africa. And then some of the Spanish joined with them. And in North Africa, some of the tribesmen south of there came and joined with them. So that soon there was an army of 80,000 starting in the eastern end of North Africa, and western end, and heading east. And within a year, they had conquered all of what we now call Morocco. And they were, I don't think the group knew much about Christianity, but they considered themselves Christians. They considered themselves Aryan Christians. And they were very strongly against Trinitarians. And so they burned and destroyed all the churches they could. And they say that many of the, in many cases, the bishop hid the church's treasure. He would bury it. And then they claimed that they would seize the bishop. And they would hold him down and put a stick to hold his mouth open and then pour vinegar or salt water or filth into his mouth until he would tell them where the treasure was. And then they would make him carry it before them. And the stories of the wretched carried on are almost unbelievable. But in a year, they conquered Morocco, and by this time, the empress had decided that Boniface wasn't really against her, and she made peace with him. So now Boniface came and said, now it's all right, please go back to Spain.
But they didn't do it. And so Boniface from now on leads the Roman armies in trying to stop them. But the force was too great, and in the course of about 3 years, they conquered all of North Africa. And any group of people has got thugs in it. And if you get a strong leadership of wicked type, and the thugs get in control, any group, any country, any group in the world can become, can lead to terrible atrocities. On the other hand, the Vandals had this wonderful general, Stilicho, who was the mainstay of the Roman Empire for 25 years until he was executed. So that, like all other groups, they had the good and the bad, but the bad was in supreme control at this particular time. And the result was that they spread further and further across North Africa, and they came to Hippo. And Hippo is just a mile from the sea, but there were two broad rivers. And there was a wall across from one river to the other, north of Hippo and another south of Hippo. So Hippo was pretty hard for them to take. So in the last few months of Augustine's life, he was closed in with the people of Hippo there, with the strong walls around, but from the high hill in the center of town, you could look out over the country and see for maybe 100 miles in all directions, and you could see the smoke coming up from buildings that were burning. And you could hear the cries of the people being looted and pillaged and taken off into captivity. And in many other towns, the Vandals, if they weren't able to take it, had simply killed thousands of people, they say, and pushed their bodies up against the wall until eventually pestilence would come into the city and the people would have to surrender. But at the end of Augustine's life, there were only 3 cities left in North Africa the Vandals hadn't taken. Carthage, the great city of North Africa, and Hippo, and one other city. And these 3 were strongly walled cities which were near the ocean. And so, at the end of Augustine's life, he saw the practical effects, that is, the effects of the practical work of his life. He saw all going up in smoke. Nothing remained but his life. And people said, this is the end of the world. Look at the terrible things that are happening around. This must be the very end of the world. And Augustine said, no, he said, the Bible describes events coming at the end of the world. They don't correspond to what has happened now. This is not yet the end of the world. But Augustine he was taken ill with a fever. He felt he was in his last illness. He retired and went to bed, and no one except the physicians were allowed to come to see him. And he had the penitential song written in large letters and posted up on the wall, and he would go over them and read them over and over, the penitential psalms. And there Augustine had died in 430 AD. And his effect was tremendous through his writing, but the effect of all the great work that he had done, the practical work, all was ended very soon, because the Vandals had taken practically all, taken all of North Africa except these 3 cities. Then shortly after Augustine's death, Boniface won a great battle against the Vandals. And the Vandal troops around Hippo went to join with the others in trying to push back Boniface's force, and that gave the people of Hippo a chance to leave the city and go the mile to the sea and get on the boat. So then they left Hippo and got, for the few that were left, and got back to Italy. And then the Vandals took the city and burned and destroyed everything in it except Augustine's home and Augustine's library. So it would look as they must have had some veneration for Augustine, even with their hatred of other things. And these were preserved, and the Arabs conquered a couple of centuries later, they conquered North Africa. But even until modern times, at this place on the Mediterranean, there has been a service held by the Arabs in memorial of a great Christian who lived at this place. And the tradition has been preserved all through. But with the people having escaped and with the library not having been destroyed, his writings were all preserved. And those who knew him in his last days lived to write memoirs of him and tell about him. And so Augustine's influence was tremendous, but he comes at the end of the ancient world, 430. You take this short history of the Christian Church, volume 3, he says 311 to 600, this book.
If you go through this book and you look at every date in it, or everything in it, and see when it occurred, you will find that 9/10 of it happens in the first half of that journey. And not over 1/10 of what is told in this book deals with the last 150 years of that 300 year period. Because your great ancient world came to an end and was destroyed with the about the middle of the 5th century AD, and your dark ages descend upon the world. And these people who, from whom mercenary soldiers had come, had been naturalized, had been integrated into the Roman people, and had become great leaders, their children and grandchildren, in the Roman Empire, they, too many of them came in at once. And the result was that the whole civilization collapsed. But Augustine's influence was great during the Middle Ages, and still greater during the period since the time of the Reformation. Now this takes us up to Roman numeral 7, the 5th century AD, and we will start at that point next semester.